In a small change in the title, there's a change in the article, but it's. I'm going to discuss some work which is actually two bodies of work. One is this work with Jayaraman, which has appeared here, and the second part of my talk will be on gauge linear sigma models. Actually, the way we were working, we actually were working on this problem, and this arose as an offshoot of this work. Hopefully, I'll show you how they are related. Okay, and this second work is supposed to appear in maybe in a week or so. There's related work for the first part of the talk from these authors, and then there's also the second part is partially related to these two talks. And of course, credit goes to Chennai Telephones because that's how Jayaraman and I collaborate. Okay. So the idea is if you're interested in studying D-brains and Calabi-Yau manifolds. For now, I'll just concentrate. Let's say this is the Kähler moduli space. I've just taken the case of the quintic. There are some special points. One is the Gapner point, where you have an exact conformal field theory description. You have a large volume point, where your normal understanding of a Calabi-Yau as a manifold makes sense. And then this is a conifold point, where the Calabi-Yau, the six brain shrinks to zero size. Okay. So this is the general picture one has. And one can discuss D-brains in several. See, these two points are special because we have different descriptions of D-brains. Okay, out here we can use boundary conformal field theory, and here we can use target space methods. Okay, and the question which one tries to understand is, what happens if I take a D-brain boundary condition or whatever from this point and try to go over here or vice versa? What happens? Okay, and of course, there are two types of B-brains. I will discuss what are called B-brains, and these wrap holomorphic cycles, and they're associated more generally with coherent sheaves, okay? And there's one issue which I will not discuss, and I'm going to pass the buck to the next speaker, is the stability. If I take some object here and transport it, it could decay, okay? This is something we will not discuss, and what I would like to show is that there is some structure which emerges which comes if you try to attempt to relate these two things without using mirror symmetry. I emphasize without using mirror symmetry. Okay. So let us take a look at B brains at the Gapner point. Let me put this picture. Okay. So there's a subclass of Gapner model of boundary states in the Gapner model, which is constructed by Recknagel and Schoemerus. So I call these the Recknagel-Schoemerus states. And for the case of the quintic, these are the labels. There's L1, L2, L3, L4, L5, and there's an M, and these are the values they take. Okay? There's something special about the case when all the Li are zero. These five D-brains are rigid, that is, they have no moduli, and they're associated with objects called exceptional bundles. Okay? And for these things, it was shown that these bundles are given by restrictions of bundles on P4. Let me remind you that the quintic can be obtained as a hypersurface in P4. So these bundles, for example, were just simple bundles on P4 which were restricted to the quintic hypersurface. Okay? And here's omega is the cotangent bundle to P4, and these are like higher exterior powers of that. And it was also conjectured by these authors that the Li not equal to zero are states, are bound states of the Li equal to zero states. It's easy to check out at the level of RR charges. But the method which was used in relating the Recknagel-Schoemerus boundary states to the large volume bundles made use of mirror symmetry, and it's quite cumbersome, at least. Okay. So is there a more straightforward relationship which does not make use of mirror symmetry? And what we will see is that actually this whole business can be done in terms of pictures. The rest of my talk could have been given that way, but I have not done it that way. So the field content of the gauge linear sigma model was discussed by the previous speaker, so I'll not go into that. There's a Fayet-Leopoldis D-term, with a parameter t, which is theta over 2 pi plus ir. R is like the Kalian modulus, it parameterizes the size, okay? So, and I can also have a superpotential. If there is no superpotential, there are two possibilities. For r greater than 0, what you obtain is that the low energy moduli space or whatever is the total space of a line bundle over some weighted projective space. I've written out for the general case. For the case of the quintic, it's O of 5 over P4. Okay? And if R is less than 0, you go to an orbifold phase where it's some quotient by a ZQP group. If there is a superpotential, so this P field is a special chiral field. It has a degree minus QP, and so you choose G to have degree plus mod QP, so this thing has total degree 0. For R greater than 0, you end up in the Calabi-Yau phase, which is a large volume phase, and for R less than 0, you end up in what is the LG phase, which is to be identified with the Gapner point, okay? So whatever you do in the L, so if you want to understand Recknagel-Schomer states, it will come from the boundary states in an LG orbifold, okay? And in a very old paper, based on some work of Warner, Jayaraman and Tapoprata Sarkar, we showed that Recknagel-Schomer states must come from Dirichlet boundary conditions in the LG orbifold, and this implies that the phi i's could be 0. You cannot turn on some number out here because this is supposed to be coordinates in projective space. So this implies that these brains are localized at the orbifold singularity, okay? And suppose I just ignored for a moment, if I ignore the superpotential, as I pointed out, you are in some orbifold point. So these are actually related to something called the fractional brains, which appear in the orbifold. Okay, notice this is not a statement made in the Gapner. This is being made from the LG viewpoint, which is not quite the Gapner model, okay? So let me say a little bit more on D-brains on the orbifold. So D-brains on the orbifold, so we'll come to CN and gamma is some discrete subgroup of SLN. And D-brains on this, there's a correspondence with representations of a quiver, which is called the Mecke quiver. There's a lot of work based on the work of Douglas and Moore. And it's best understood by considering the world volume of the gauge theory, and it's given by a quiver which has vertices, and it's a bunch of arrows which connect various vertices, okay? For the case of the quintic, you have 5 vertices and arrows connecting all of them, and these are 5 arrows, okay? And the vertices of the quiver are actually associated with fractional brains, and in some sense, these are the building blocks. Okay, so I'll just call X the resolution of Cn mod gamma given by the gauge linear sigma model. For the quintic, it's actually the total space of O phi over P4. But a little later, I realized as I wrote my talk, X only refers to P4. I apologize for the mix-up. Okay. Okay, so Dykonescu and Douglas propose a dual relationship between two sets of objects. These essays, okay, are actually associated with the fractional brains. Okay, now I've jumped a little bit. Okay, so what we are trying to do is we have some fractional brains on this space. We would like to understand what are these things associated in the resolved space. Okay, and let's suppose that the essays, whatever these essays are, these are associated with fractional brains. That is, these are bundles with compact support, thus which live on the things which you've blown up. So if you take the case of the quintic, these are things which live on P4, okay? And here, these are something called the tautological line bundles, and these form a basis for K of X, okay? And the duality is as follows, okay? So RAs are a set of bundles, and so are the SAs, and it's given by what I call the Euler form, and it's just they are dual to each other in this special sense. Okay, and let me explain what one means by chi of E1, E2. So what you do is you consider an annulus. Okay, this is this direction. The vertical direction is time, which I've added. It's Euclidean time. And I have boundary conditions associated to a vector bundle E1 and E2 on this side. And you have an open string going from this point to this point. And you can ask, what are the number of Ramon ground states? And this, in some sense, is a weighted sum of the ground states. Okay, so this is the way to think about it. It is sum and over I minus power I, number of Ramon ground states with charge I. Okay, this charge is with respect to the unbroken U1. And the mathematical way of writing it is as follows. These X groups are basically for vector bundles, it's just the cohomology. Okay. Douglas and Iaconescu actually went further. They actually proposed inverse toric construction by which you can actually recover the tautological bundles from which you can construct the SAs. Okay? But this method is tedious. Okay. So this is where our work comes in. What we observed is that actually, these RAs, these are a set of bundles, they form the foundation of a helix. Okay, so I have to now explain to you what a helix is. Okay. So first definition is a vector bundle is exceptional if it has the following properties, but it's simplest to understand if you just look at it and look at there's only one Ramon ground state of charge zero. Okay, that's the way to think about it. Okay. And if you have a collection of these objects, it's called exceptional if, so this is just a statement about the number of Ramon ground states, okay? That means Ramon ground states exist only in the zero charge sector, and this object is upper triangular with ones on the diagonal, okay? It's just a property. Okay. So if you're given an exceptional sheaves, there's a way of constructing new ones. So what you do is, let's say there's a pair. These satisfy the properties which I had written earlier. There's something called a left mutation. Similarly, there's a right mutation, which basically corresponds to taking this guy through to the other side and pushing it through. But what you get in the process is a new bundle. On the A-brain side, this corresponds to brain creation. Okay, and this appeared in the work of Horik Balbafa. Okay, and the new sheaf is given by a sequence of this kind. Okay, but bottom line is that if this exists, there's a canonical procedure to construct this new bundle, okay? The simplest thing you can observe is that the churn characters, which is related to the Ramon-Ramon charges, satisfy this property. Okay. So an exceptional collection, okay? This is an exceptional collection which has actually infinite entries, okay? It's called a helix of period P. If you did a sequence of P minus one mutations, you actually come back to the helix, but with a shift of P. Okay, it's just some operation, but you keep shifting it P minus one times, you actually get an entry which is already, you're back to the original thing, okay? It's just a shift in the helix, and that's why it's called a helix. So it actually suffices to consider any collection of P consecutive elements, and this is from this you can actually recover the rest of the helix because of the shift property, okay? And that's called the foundation of the helix. So all this is very complicated, but that's a very simple property. Okay? And for the example of Pn, the tautological line bundles are very simple. This is it. Okay. So I'll place the result in the form of two conjectures. The first conjecture is that the large volume monodromy, that is T goes to T plus 1, so first thing I would like to emphasize is all this construction is being done here. There's nothing really to do with this point. I'm just doing honest-to-goodness bundles and stuff like that on a regular Calabi-Yau manifold. Okay? So out here, I can do the following thing. T goes to T plus 1 is just going around this point, going around this once. Okay? The large volume monodromy on O, what is O? This is just a bundle which wraps all of P4, if you wish. Okay? This is the simplest object, and it is rigid. Okay? And it produces an exceptional collection. That's because these operations do not change, for example, the moduli and things like stability, so you get a whole sequence, which, and it has to terminate somewhere, okay? First observation is that the period P turns out to reflect the quantum symmetry, ZP symmetry, which you find. So for example, if you take the quintic, you know that there is a quantum Z5 symmetry associated with the Kähler moduli space, and this period actually reflects it. This is kind of amazing, okay? Further, the procedure seems to work even for cases when X is not fully resolved. So the analog of P4 is some weighted projective space, and the weighted projective spaces are typically singular. The non-singular ones are exceptions, okay? And in the cases when there are more than one moduli, then you can, for each of these moduli, there is this parameter, complex Kähler parameter, and you can do a shift for each of them. So you actually get a d-dimensional lattice, but the helix is one, it's a one-dimensional sublattice, okay? But you can figure out what that is, okay? And we have actually explicitly verified that this is true. Conjecture two is that all exceptional bundles on X are generated by mutations. Okay, so in particular, you can show that there is a mutated helix with this property, whose entries are actually basically L. These are just A minus one mutations of the various entries of the original helix, which I started. Remember, the R's were just nothing but I started with the brain which wrapped all of X and then did monodromy on that, and I got these things, okay? And this, the fact that this satisfies is a very simple property which follows, in some sense, what you're doing is if you're given an upper triangular matrix and then you're trying to diagonalize it, okay, this is just the process of figuring out the S's. It's just the, it follows from that sort of a thing. And the crucial observation is the restriction of these SAs to the Calabi-Yau hypersurface gives the all the Li equals 0 RS state in all the examples we have considered so far. Okay? So in other words, here we have done some construction out here, and then we have shown that these actually turned out to be the natural objects which came out here. Okay? For the case of X equal to Pn, this is actually a very well-known result that the RA, which I mentioned, generate all sheaves on Pn. Actually, this is a result of the Rudakov group. Okay? And this follows from Balanchine's theorem for vector bundles on Pn. And actually, this follows, this structure actually implies that such a generalization exists for weighted projective spaces as well. Okay? This is actually implicit in the work of Douglas and Iaconescu, so it's not. Okay? So the question is, as I pointed out, all the things we have done is out here, but at some point we would like to go back to this, and I've been hinting that there is some structure which is related, but there's something we can do even better. It turns out that if you're given a helix, you can actually construct a quiver. We call this the Balanchine quiver. We'll draw a picture later. So the quiver's vertices are associated with the RIs, and then you draw as many maps as you can go from RI to these arrows, beginning from vertex I and ending at vertex J. Okay? And there will be relations. They're obvious ones. So if you take the case of X equal to P4, R equal to 001 to 04, okay? And if you look at this, if I take OI to OI plus 1, these are two neighboring elements, it is just multiplication by phi I. So it's a very trivial thing to see that you have five vertices and maps, okay, which connect. There are five arrows in each of these things. And representations of this quiver, if you wish, give some class of vector bundles on P4. So the question is, all this is out here, how do we go here? And the answer is very cute. It's what I call the return of the P field. So we constructed a Balanchine quiver. I've just redrawn the quiver of the previous page, okay, with the black arrows. And if you look, if you remember the earlier quiver which I had drawn in the case of P4, okay, fractional brains on C5 or Z5, you find that these arrows are missing. And the point is, these are maps of the form P times VI. Okay, the P field in this large volume limit as zero web, okay, so it cannot contribute here. But in the LG phase, it is non-zero web. So these are maps which do not exist in the Calabi-Yau phase, but they actually show up in the LG phase. And you actually go from the Bailey-Linson quiver to what is called the Mackey quiver. Okay, it's another cute example. This has to do with the flop. Okay, so the flop, there's a local model. In the gauge linear sigma model, you consider four fields, phi1 to phi4. This is due to Witten. They have charges plus one and two with minus one. Okay, so in the limit r greater than 0, you set these two guys to 0, so you have only maps going this way. But when you go to r less than 0, these two guys are switched off and these are turned on. So these two play the role of the P field here, and you actually lose these two arrows, but you gain these two arrows. Okay? It just follows by using this sort of a picture. It turns out that this is actually related in the language of quivers or representations of quivers as to a change of tree structure. Okay, this was told to us by Sparsarthi, who's done quite a bit of work on this. And in this context, the change of tree structure just corresponds. So this is, for example, a sink in the sense that all arrows come into this thing. And it corresponds to reversing all arrows at a sink, which is what this is. So in some cases, these correspond to a change of tree structure. Okay. So this comes to my second part of the talk, okay? And what we were trying to do was to construct vector bundles in the gauge linear sigma model with boundary. Okay, there was some work discussed in the Strings 2000 by Kashru. So the idea is you take holomorphic bundles, and they can be constructed by something called a monad, which is as follows. You consider a sequence. A, B, and C are bundles, and A, B are certain maps with these properties. Sometimes you'll relax some conditions. A bundle, holomorphic bundle E, is given by the kernel of this map, quotiented by the image, okay? And the way to realize this was discussed by Witten. You consider fermions pi A, which are sections of the B, of the bundle B, the middle guy, and you realize the map A as some kind of a gauge invariance, which you can gauge fix in this particular form, and the map B imposes a holomorphic constraint, okay? So let me go back to this thing. This is a holomorphic constraint, while this is some kind of a gauge invariance. So before we understand how to implement this in the GLSM, I need to understand what happens to the bulk multiplets on the boundary. In the bulk, you have 2-2 symmetry, but only one linear combination of that is preserved. So if you work it out for the case of B brains, if you take a chiral multiplet, it decomposes into a chiral multiplet of lesser supersymmetry and a Fermi multiplet, okay? And if you take a twisted chiral, it becomes a complex unconstrained multiplet. Finally, if you consider the gauge field, it is this particular combination, V0 plus sigma bar over root 2, which actually functions, takes the role of a boundary gauge field, okay? So on the boundary, we introduce Fermi multiplets, okay, which satisfy this condition. And we introduce extra chiral multiplet, which I call sigma prime. Okay, and these phi primes are actually restrictions of the bulk fields on the boundary. Okay, so this actually is some gauge fixed version of the gauge invariance, which I talked about. And the holomorphic constraints require the additional introduction of a boundary chiral multiplet. Okay, so far the story is quite similar to the 0-2 construction. Now comes the new ingredient, is that the large volume monodromy of the vector bundles must be implemented. We already saw that if I started out with a bundle O and took it around this point once, I get O1, okay? So if I take theta to theta plus 2 pi, it's just, if I take an arbitrary bundle E, it actually corresponds to E tensor O minus 1, okay? In the monad construction, this is very simple. If you're given a bundle E and you're asked, how do I construct a bundle E of N? The answer is very simple. Shift all the charges by N. Okay, that's it. So simple. But in the gauge linear sigma model, the way this arises is through the addition of boundary contact terms. Okay? Part of it can be fixed in the NLSM limit, which is the limit when you take E squared to be infinity and also R to be very large. You can fix this thing. Okay? But the real non-trivial part in this whole business is that the boundary conditions in the GLSM must have a proper NLSM limit. This was something which was actually considered extensively in unpublished work by Ogiri, Lawrence, Jayaraman, and Tapobrata way back in 97. Okay. And more recently by Sarkar in Tapobrata's thesis in this paper. Okay, this is a non-trivial constraint, and it leads to 1 over E square corrections to the NLSM boundary condition. And important business is the vector multiplet has to be treated carefully. Okay? What happens is that you can find several classes of boundary conditions in the gauge linear sigma model, but they do not have a proper NLSM limit. So what follows from this constraint is that you just cannot blindly pick boundary conditions in the gauge linear sigma model. Okay, so this just gives a summary of the work which is supposed to appear. And I have not addressed the issue of stability of B-brains. And this is the last transparency. Okay, thank you.
If there are no questions, let's thank the speaker again.